pussy sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you'll hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, and sometimes other parts of the state, written by local authors. For the next half hour, I'll continue reading from What Makes Us Southern, a collection of essays by contributors to Our State magazine, published as a book in 2013. Spanish Moss by Michael Parker. I'm not sure where Spanish moss makes its first appearance in the trees of Sampson County, but I can pinpoint a place in Clinton where I first came upon it. My high school English teacher, a close friend of the family, lived a couple miles west of town. Her house sat off the road among orderly rows of pines. Moss hung from the limbs, and one Halloween I picked up a fallen tress, tucked it into my father's crimped fedora, and roamed the streets dressed, in those pre-politically correct days, as a bum. I'm not sure what led me to believe that bums sprouted wild gray dreadlocks, but I do remember the feel of the moss on the back of my neck and its smell, which, after a few hours trolling neighborhoods for sweets, resembled washed-up seaweed you pluck from the beach and decide to take home with you until, after an hour or two in the car with the windows rolled up, you realize that some forms of nature are best left in nature. As dean of students at the local community college, my mother traveled the county recruiting high school students. Often, she took my brother and sister and me along. Even in elementary school, I sensed the difference in the southern end of the county. We'd take two tracks of thick, white sand through scrubby woods of cypress and oak. On saggy cabins, cotton balls studded porch and front porch screens to ward off flies. Overhead, the tree limbs seemed about to snap under the weight of the exotic Spanish moss. Spanish moss is neither Spanish nor, technically, moss. It belongs to the angiosperm family and, according to one legend, got its name from a tale about an 18th-century couple, a man and his Spanish fiancée, who, searching for a place to build a plantation near Charleston, South Carolina, were attacked by Cherokees. After killing the couple, the Cherokees cut off the Spanish woman's long black tresses and tossed them onto the branch of a live oak, where they turned gray and spread across the southeast. Over time, Spanish moss became a fixture of the Southern Gothic, and even now crops up in movies set in the South, made mostly by outsiders who portray the region with easy stereotypes and overwrought accents. Moonlight, magnolias, and moss. Symbols of a mysterious and arcane region where the past, as Faulkner famously said, is never dead. It is not even past. There's something primitive, even prehistoric, about the plant, not to mention haunting. Over the years, it developed its own vocabulary. It drapes and it drips. It never droops or dangles. That the verbs used to describe the way it hangs have been worn threadbare only attests to its place of honor in our landscape, for clichés, however bland and tired, are born out of truth. In truth, Spanish moss drips from trees. Branches are draped with it. Beards, tresses, locks. We anthropomorphize it because, even though it appears not only dead but decades dead, even centuries, it lives vibrantly in our identity. Wind or nesting birds spread it from tree to tree. But compared to kudzu, another stock symbol of the Southern Gothic, which does not so much spread as devour, it's hard to imagine Spanish moss not having always been here. Maybe its grayness renders it antediluvian. All I know is that years ago, when I first came upon it as a child, it felt alive in the now, but a harbinger of then. Years of living either out of state or in the moss-deprived Piedmont have made me nostalgic for it. Last year, on my daughter's spring break from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, I suggested a pilgrimage down east. My daughter had never really seen Sampson County, except to drive through it on the way to the beach. Unlike most college students who are asked to spend spring break riding around in a Toyota with their dad and listening to him wax nostalgic about nights listening to the Tams and the Drifters at Lake Artesia and working in the old produce market in Faison, she actually appeared eager, if not fascinated. We headed out from Greensboro down U.S. Highway 421, for interstates are the enemy of exploration. A couple of hours later, driving the length of Sampson County, we passed from Tobacco Field and Pine Forest, a few miles outside of Dunn, to the sunken, swampy lushness of Ivanhoe on the banks of the Black River. Perhaps the most noticeable aspect of the largest county in the state is the fact that, like most states, it includes different landscapes and ecosystems. I've always preferred that end of the county to the flat and crop-dominated land north of Clinton. Down south, little of the land is cleared. The roads are limned by shadow from the overhanging trees, the scrub nearly impenetrable. From Ivanhoe, my daughter and I took a side road down to Carr Station. Past a bridge over the Black River, we pulled into a parking lot, doubtless improvised by fishermen. But, except for us, no one was around that day in early spring. The river was quiet and slow, its waters tannic-laced, more the color of cola when you're standing beside it, but certainly black from a distance. Cypress trees dominated the banks, their knees creating eddies in the barely perceptible current. From their branches hung the first moss that we'd seen that day, and it was everywhere overhead, thick and moody. "Check out that moss. I love it, don't you?" I said. The sight of it, still on that windless day, made me oversell it. "Kind of creepy," she said. "But in a good way, right?" "Right, Dad," she said, as if she sensed in my exuberance a need to make her appreciate it. I told her about the times, back when we lived in Elizabeth City, when she was 2 years old, when we drove over to Gates County and rented canoes to paddle around Merchant's Mill Pond, the trees of which are so laden with moss it seems impossible that they're standing. And the next day we passed through the Green Swamp and stopped at Lake Waccamaw, another place where moss is more abundant. But what I could not seem to communicate was how much I preferred the Spanish moss of Lower Sampson. It comes upon you suddenly, and it seems that you're not only moving from one habitat to another, but also from the present into the past. And that is exactly where I was headed that day. I suspect the sight of moss will always usher me backward, and in a good way, too. Hammocks by Duncan Merle. In a clearing among the oaks of Salter Path, there is a hammock. And upon this hammock, I once dreamed that time had expanded and become nearly infinite, even for as small a mortal speck of creation as me, and that I would have all the time I needed to get out of that hammock and on down to Frost's Seafood House for breakfast. It was good that I had all the time I needed, that each second had swelled to encompass the growing universe and all of its comets and suns, that time was like, dude, the sand trail of that little crab right there, winding and twisting back on itself, and the endless circle of, oh man, look at that big pelican, he's so weird. I was having a hard time getting out of the hammock, is what I'm trying to say. I don't mean that I was reluctant to get out of the hammock. I was hungry and needed eggs to fuel my later study of hammock aerodynamics and nap engineering, scheduled for immediately after breakfast. When I say I had a hard time getting out, I meant that I could not physically remove myself from the thing. The hammock had closed up around me, as hammocks do. I had a vision of dying to the world within its precisely knotted and airy shroud for want of a graceful way to get out. The hammock would not let me go, unless I was prepared to utterly reject it for terra firma, which meant dumping myself out onto the sandy soil at the feet of the windswept oaks. I assume I did this, eventually, as I am not still in the hammock, and I recount this moment, one of hundreds of my hammock moments, only to illustrate the first principle of hammockology, which is, you must commit to the hammock. The hammock will not let you go easily. It isn't a bed or a couch from which you can leap up at a moment's notice to attend to the world. A hammock demands that it be given time, and the best kind of time is leisure time, as we all know. Southerners have long fought the idea that they are infinitely lazy. What this Southerner prefers to think is that he is unusually capable of commitment to leisure. He is not undecided about the merits of sitting still, and he doesn't need a guru or a life coach to tell him that a gentle rocking in the breeze is worth setting aside the concerns of the world. The magazines shout at him, "Simplify now! 10 things you must do to lower stress today!" He considers these imperatives, but they only make him want to close his eyes and, hey, there's that pelican again. And the crab, silly thing. The Southerner is not afraid of the hammock, because the Southerner is not afraid of time. The Southerner's sense of time is expansive. It stretches across the centuries, and takes in the panoply of souls that rose, animate, blood kin and not, venerated and despised, chained and unchained, a people divided against itself, one people of the twang, an operatic chorus describing the strange fruit of their long history together. The Southerner is conscious of eons, and against that scale of time, each second is nothing, a flash, and not anything that must always be crammed full. We will all be dust, the Southerner knows. So the Southerner stops. The Southerner remembers. The Southerner falls asleep in the hammock, with Mr. Wolfe's novel butterflied on his chest, vaguely aware of the rough lattice of thread and fiber pressed against his cheek. And he dreams. I am always home, sir, and I am always going there, too. Down those centuries, the hammock accompanied us. From the New World, where we found them strung up by the first people high above the leaf litter and biting ants of the tropical forest, to the Old World, and back again, below decks where sailors slept steadily rocking, bearded and grog-happy pendula always oriented in line with gravity, and never tossed out upon the deck. Blackbeard surely slept in a hammock, it being impossible to imagine the old captain at sea laid down in anything so domestic as a bed. I am a hammock enthusiast, and therefore the descendant of pirates and privateers, a free man floating weightless above the entanglements of ground and soil. You may keep your pied-à-terre. I will carry my resting place with me. In fact, I want to unfurl it right now. The very idea of essaying about a hammock has made me sleepy, and it has not escaped me that tap-tap-tapping at this keyboard is nearly the opposite of resting in a hammock. I might as well be swinging a hammer. That 9-pound hammer that killed John Henry ain't gonna kill me, ain't gonna kill me. Roll on, buddy, don't you roll so slow. Baby, how can I roll when the wheels won't go? It won't kill me, because I'll be asleep and not trying to tunnel through a mountain in a race against a machine. The machines lost that particular battle against old, hard-working, and restless John Henry. But does anyone really doubt that they won the war? I will not fight them, but at times I will ignore them. I will, instead, go outside into the shade behind the old house in Beaufort, beyond the sound of the air conditioner and the refrigerator and the electric sandwich maker, and I will tie up my hammock with my own fat fingers from the crooked branches of asymmetrical old trees, and allow myself to be cooled, supine, in the breeze that has blown across that same inlet since before the first man stood up, became self-aware, and began to look for shade and a cool drink. This is the Southerner's sense of time. Breezes are ancient, and hammocks are so simple they're subversive. This simplicity, this rudimentary perfection, is worth preserving. One must reject all manner of tassels and fringe. The spreader bars of the local hammock variants are acceptable, those types native to Nag's Head and Hatteras. The important rule, though, is that the hammock should retain its primitivity. Otherwise, you're building yourself a bed, and that's just a quick step from getting a mortgage. Just for 1 hour, once during the week you grudgingly allow yourself for vacation, would it kill you to be irresponsible and not so securely fastened to the things of this world? Forget what your stuff looks like, and who designed it, and whether it's the same brand as that thing in that movie with the lighthouses and the sand and the pretty people. There are some things that invite us to set aside such worries, that are so simple, a sling between two trees, that to embellish them is to miss the point entirely. Whether woven from braided unicorn hair, or fashioned from a set of old curtains strung up with grappling hooks and jumper cables, the hammock invites us to quit worrying. It will not let us go easily. It is simple. It is old. It is portable. It is perfect. And there's always one to be found in those places where people think it is perfectly fine to stop and consider, at length, the twisting thread of time that has not culminated in us, but is ours only for this moment. This is North Carolina. This is why we live here. There is no elongation of the space-time continuum here, and time is the same as it is everywhere else. But even so, doesn't it seem, sometimes, when you're in your backyard, in the ratty old hammock your family has condemned as unsafe, counting willow oak leaves as they spin on their longitudinal axis down slight hills of air toward you, vaguely hearing your daughters playing their ancient games of mimicry, doesn't it seem, then, that there's just more time here? You must commit to the hammock. Sunday Drives by Michael Parker. Never in my house was it, "Let's go for a ride." Always, and impromptu, although ever anticipated on those steamy, buggy late summer nights, or languorous Sunday afternoons of my youth, my father said, when he was ready to ramble about town and through the countryside, "Let's go to ride." It did not occur to me then to question his choice of preposition. I wasn't studying linguistics in elementary school. How he happened to marshal his troops was immaterial, for I'd been waiting all day, sometimes all weekend, to hear those strange but familiar words, to climb in that car with my parents and some or all of my siblings, and go for an aimless cruise. I say aimless, but there was a pattern, faint and ever-shifting as it might have been. We'd head from our house 2 miles from the center of Clinton up the Faircloth Freeway, the new stretch of four-lane named for a local boy turned state senator, and hang a right on NC-24 toward Fayetteville. A mile or so in, past what we called, for reasons I could only assume had to do with a preponderance of Johnsons, Johnsontown, we'd veer off into the back entrance of the Coharie Country Club. Back in the late 60s and early 70s, sandy cocklebird lots thick with pine trees that covered the soil year-round with pine straw were being snapped up by people who could afford to live on the seventh hole of the only golf course in the county. Roads, mostly cul-de-sacs, cropped up in a matter of weeks, flags marking property lines, cement mixers poised to lay the foundation of a French provincial or Charleston Lowcountry-style cottage tucked up along a fairway. The country club, essentially a loop, was an easy cruise, and an obligatory one. The main road skirted the greens and fairways, the putting green and pro shop, then dumped us back out on Highway 24. Across the street from the country club was a newer development, named Fox Lake, after the residence it displaced, although there were fox sightings as late as the mid-70s. The road circled the man-made lake, and my mother and father studied the housing starts or already completed brick ranchers, and told stories about who lived there, where they had lived previously, how many children they had, what line of work they were in, sometimes what church they belonged to. New neighborhoods were infinitely more explorable than the older and more familiar sections hugging the courthouse square, for they suggested growth in a town where the population, about 7,000, had remained the same for a long time. Progress and prosperity were important to my father, the editor of the local newspaper, and my mother, dean of students of the local community college. Even though they weren't natives, they had an investment in the community, for they were the types to invest in the community. But going to ride was not work, it was leisure. That was the point, to get out of the house, to open the car windows wide in those pre-air-conditioned days, and whip up a summer breeze, to wander. Rides were also entertainment, fodder for stories. My father could not pass a house without doling out an anecdote about its inhabitants. My mother knew as much as he did about who lived where and did what, but she was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, so she was a little tighter with the reins of what her father might have deemed idle chatter. That so many of our rides took place on Sunday afternoon suggested to me, much later, that going to ride was a secular extension of the morning of worship. If true religion requires a vigilant attentiveness to the world around you, its changes and its failings, going to ride was a journey through examples of the beauty of nature, of the occasional sign of greed, of the duty emphasized by more enlightened churches to the community. We witnessed poverty, too, on those rides. My father took us through the back streets, unpaved and potholed, of what was then called, by the white population, without the slightest awareness or shame, colored town. The divide between Main Street, with its regal Victorians and antebellum oaks, and the side streets off McCoy or Sampson Streets, shotguns and unpainted mill shacks, weedy lots and abandoned vehicles, was obvious and instructive. So maybe those rides weren't only leisure or entertainment. Our parents taught by example, and they did not try to hide us from the world's ills. They were not the type, and still aren't, to lecture. They were the type to question the world around them and their children's place in that world. Not having an answer to their question was not likely to draw or rebuke, for they realized that for most of society's ills there are no easy answers, and the answers that come to you are often ephemeral. But the questions they plant are finally more powerful than any answer, for questions, unlike answers, are niggling. They remain within you, nagging, begging you to reconsider, to adapt, to accept and enact change. But back then, I just knew that we were getting in a station wagon and going to ride. Sometimes on summer nights, the city truck we called the Mosquito Man cruised the streets, spraying a thick plume of DDT. We had the sense to roll up the windows, more because of the smell than the fact that we were breathing poison, although no one knew that then, as attested by the way that the Mosquito Man's vehicle often looked like a fire truck in a downtown parade, a string of cars following along as if in celebration of homecoming or holiday. Sometimes you even saw neighborhood kids tailing the truck, as Rodney Crowell describes in his song Telephone Road. Mosquito trucks spraying DDT, barefoot heathens running wild and free. After we exhausted the town roads, we broke into the country. There wasn't exactly a transition, for most roads out of town were overtaken immediately after the last house or country store by tobacco, corn, or produce fields. Country drives were slightly less interesting to me as a child. There seemed less to look at, for I had not yet cottoned to the barren beauty of field and pine forest that is eastern North Carolina. In time, however, they would come to fascinate and placate me. At some point in high school, my friends Sam and I took long drives, mostly through the southern end of the county. On my rides with Sam, I discovered the dilatory and slightly gothic Black River, fishing shacks tucked up along its banks. We'd drive to Ivanhoe and Harold's Store and Carr Station on a rainy Sunday, and the muddy, stubbled cornfields and the line of pines ringing them, softened in the distance by a steady drizzle, brought on a melancholy I mistook for profundity. It was then, and is now in memory, akin to some foreign explorer seeing for the first time the beauty of a region at first glance not particularly comely. Those rides with Sam, who passed away some years ago, taught me to see the place I grew up in, to understand its culture, to marvel at the old farmhouses wrestled to the ground by kudzu, the tobacco barns constructed of logs chinked with concrete, idle now that farmers cure their crops in metal boxes. But these being high school days, most of our rides stayed within the city limits. How many times have I heard, talking to others about their experience growing up in small North Carolina towns, that there wasn't anything to do but ride around. We got our driver's licenses and joined the circuit of cruisers making their loops around town. These days, small towns are relished by those escaping suburbs who complain about being too often stuck on freeways or spending hours planning routes designed to avoid getting stuck on freeways. Small towns feel idyllic because you can get away from car culture. You can walk to the grocery store, the farmer's market, the drugstore, the diner. We could easily have walked to Butler's drugstore for a Cherry Coke, or to the Colonial, or A&P, or the Piggly Wiggly. But We spent nearly all our time in cars. I remember watching some television, and I remember listening to a lot of records. But what I mostly remember from my adolescence is the inordinate amount of time I spent riding around. If half your life is spent asleep, for rural North Carolinians of a certain age, the other half is spent in perpetual orbit designed by your particular clique. In Clinton, in the mid-1970s, a certain type of teen, girls with elaborate shag haircuts, boys with blown-dry, unnaturally kempt hair, flowered silk shirts, and platform shoes, halted their circling to hang out in the parking lot of Hardee's. Another crowd broke their loop at McDonald's. My crowd hung out, believe it or not, in the parking lot of a laundromat called the Glamorama. This was around the time that David Bowie and T-Rex popularized the glitzy theatrical brand of music called glam rock. But the Glamorama had nothing to do with glitz. It was open late and drew tired-looking women who moved as if they had worked double shifts, their cars sunken with laundry, and so many small kids that half of them had to have been cousins. We liked it because there were two pinball machines, and the management left us alone, and most of our high school had too much respect to break their orbit in a sad laundromat, thus allowing us a kind of refuge from which to judge those we called the Hardee Boys, who listened only to Boz Scaggs and drove Monte Carlos and Grand Prix instead of the station wagons and pickups we borrowed from our parents. There is a photo, somewhere, of my mother and father on a back road of Chatham County. My father is standing on a rise above the car, which looks to be a station wagon from the early 50s, taking a photo both of the landscape and of my mother, who, still seated in the passenger's seat, is turned toward him with one of the most beatific smiles I've ever seen on her face or anyone else's. I can't glance at that photo without tasting kicked-up dust, a briny flavor peculiar to the red clay of the Piedmont, and smell the metal of that part of station wagons we christened the very back, which, oddly enough, was coveted among the five of us, perhaps because you could see the world after it passed through the vision of those up front, allowing you time to savor the sky, like a pot of Brunswick stew that tastes better as a leftover. I asked my father about that photo the other day, trying to determine where it was taken and why he was there. "I couldn't tell you where, but I could take you there," he said, which told me all I needed to know about the place, that he and my mother discovered it one afternoon while going to ride, and that the look on my mother's face reflects the pleasure experienced when you find something beautiful made all the more mysterious by the fact that you weren't looking for it. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.